This is Back to Back.
Yo, what's up, Back to Backers? This is Willie Joy. Welcome to the show. This is Back to Back. This is my podcast. Guys, we made it. The last episode of 2021. What a year. I've had less weird years, but I want to say for the podcast, I'm very happy to have two new guests on the show, long requested. It feels good to end the year like this. This is the right episode. I've got Claude Von Stroke and Lubelski on the show. And look, this was so much fun. I might have to start doing more two guest interviews because this was great. Lubelski just released his new album called Happy Accidents, which is out right now on Dirty Bird, the label, of course, owned and operated by Claude Von Stroke. And on that album, they have a collab together on there called Ice Cream Cone. So Happy Accidents is the album by Lubelski. It came about, as you're about to hear, through a series of streams that Lubelski was doing for Claude Von Stroke's Dirty Bird Twitch channel. He was doing all this live improvisation on his analog gear, and he took all of these hours and hours and hours of improv and whittled it down to the best bits, turned them into songs, and we get the Happy Accidents album. It's a fantastic album. It's out now. Go get it. The link for that is in the description of this episode, as well as where you can go see Claude Von Stroke, go see Lubelski. They've been doing some tour dates together. You gotta go see them when they're in your town. Claude Von Stroke, of course, just insanely prolific. We talk about his nonstop productivity in the conversation you're about to hear. Always new singles, always new tunes, EPs. Dirty Bird, the releases are crazy. The events, of course, Dirty Bird Campout, the most famous one, but they do so much. It's ridiculous. So there's going to be links for all of that. Claude, Lubelski, Dirty Bird. Check the description and you will find all of it. You'll also find another link to come join me, hang out with me on the Back-to-Back Discord. If you want to come give your 2022 predictions for what's going to happen in dance music, if you want to come tell me what you would like to see for the podcast in the new year, any of that, come holler at me, harass me on the Discord. I love widening the ever-expanding circle of excellent people who I've met through doing this, and the Back-to-Back Discord is a great place to do that. You can also find me on social media, as always, at Willie Joy. The show is at Back to Back Pod. Social media, and of course, just generally spreading the word, telling people about this show, turning on your friends who love music the same way you do onto this podcast. That's the best way to support Back to Back. That is the best way to support me, to help me keep making these episodes every single week. For almost the past 5 years, we're going to hit 5 years in 2022. Can't believe it. And a lot of that is due to your support. So keep spreading the word. Thank you for all the support thus far. And I hope you guys are having good holidays out there. I hope your year is wrapping up well. I hope this episode fits in nicely with whatever you got going on. This was a good one, man. We had such a good time. I love talking to them. It's really nice, their dynamic, their back and forth. A couple times, all I had to do was just sit back and let them ask each other questions. It was fantastic. I really like their contrasting attitudes about creativity, songwriting philosophy, different places in their career, all of that. It made for a really fascinating discussion. You could tell immediately their chemistry, why they work so well together. Look, before we get into it, I love all of y'all out there. Please be safe this holiday season, this New Year's. You know, the world is starting to feel a little wild again. COVID's letting it rip again. So take care of yourselves. Be smart out there. And most of all, I hope you get to relax. I hope you get to have some fun. I hope you get to put whatever's on your mind behind you for a little bit. I think that's what any of us should be asking for out of a holiday break. I'm grateful for all of you. I'm looking forward to all of the episodes that I'm going to make and we're going to enjoy in the new year. But for now, this is the perfect one to end it off. Enjoy it. It's all yours. Let's do this one last time for 2021. This is me and Claude Von Stroke and Lubelski back to back. Let's go.
We live. live together. No, we don't. I'm just a homeless guy that stops by and takes cans out of his recycling.
I mean, it's cool to do like a joint interview. It's rare that I do these and get to do these, but I like that dynamic. I mean, maybe a good way to start and jump into it is to talk about how you guys met each other. Do you remember the first time you met?
They might be different stories. I had met Claude a few times, but I don't think he remembered me until it was like the first Dirty Bird camp out and I showed up early and I played with Wyatt at the pre-party. And yeah, I was just like playing like a bunch of like old Dirty Bird tracks. And then my girlfriend at the time was like, "This is Lebelski. Like, he's super cool." And Barkley's like, "You're really going to talk up your boyfriend to me right now?"
That was not the first Dirty Bird camp out, but I do remember
the second one. That was like the first time that we like connected, I think.
I do remember your girlfriend being your like hype person and definitely being like, "This is going to be the thing. This is Lebelski."
I remember I was really stoked that you could pronounce my name like correctly, like right off the bat. I don't think a lot of people could do that. A lot of people are like when I met Mikey Lyon, he was like, "Lebowski, Lebelski." Right. But you were just like, "Lebelski."
Well,
like,
Wyatt Marshall worked here as my studio assistant and he's friends with Jake. So I also saw Jake in other weird scenarios, like at NAMM, and they'd be like, "Yeah, Jake's into modular." And they'd be like, "He's in the modular section. Maybe we should go talk to him."
Jake, is that usually where you can be found, in the modular section?
It's like the only place I spend time at. And when NAMM goes on and I go out there, I just like go and mess around with all the new modules. And I remember they had like a bunch of modules I had no idea how to work at all. And Wyatt and Barkley showed up and I was just like, had to pretend like I knew what I was doing.
I don't remember that. I just remember being like, "Okay.
Yeah.
you know about stuff."
Well, Barkley, let me ask you, because Jake, I know you're big in the modular world and that, you know, your relationship with technology informs a lot of your music in general. But Barkley, when I knew we were coming to talk, I was going through old interviews with both of you guys and just do a little research. And I saw an old quote of yours from an old interview. And I don't have the exact quote, but it was something paraphrased along the lines that when you first started off, you were sort of a purist technologically, and it was really important to you to, you know, use only pristine analog gear, really go to the roots of it. And then at a certain point you became maybe less precious about that.
Yeah. It wasn't that exactly. I remember it wasn't analog gear. It was just I was one of those people that's like, unless I created every sound in the song from scratch, then it wasn't cool.
Mm.
And then I realized like, yeah, but if you actually want to finish a song, you might want to use some drum sounds from somewhere, or like you might actually want to finish the song instead of being like 6 months into the song and the song has like 800 changes and nobody even knows it's a song by the time it's done.
Right. Well, where do you fall with it today? How do you feel, you know, in terms of you sitting down to write a track today, how much of it is analog? How much of it do you play with sampling these days? What does it look like?
I only have one kind of purist rule. I'll use anything. I use analog gear and VSTs and whatever. It doesn't matter to me at all. Machine, drum machines, push, whatever, Ableton, Reason. I don't care how it gets done. I'll try anything. The only thing that I don't do is sample, like lift. I sample drums, but I don't lift any like parts of songs, like traditional hip hop style sampling. I don't do anything, any of that. Right. I never lift samples, basically, like music samples.
And is that more of a philosophical stance or more of just a I don't want to deal with the headache stance?
It's a both. I always thought that, like, I kind of had this like moment when I realized that all the hip hop that I like adored was not even like their music. but I was still like, it's still cool, but I don't know. I just was like, yeah, unless you're, it's just a personal choice. I'm like, unless I made it, then what am I really doing? I'm just doing like a remix.
Hmm. Yeah. That's a really interesting stance. Cause I think you can see both sides of it. And I like that you kind of made the strong choice. Cause I think it comes through in your music too, that there is, I don't know. I just like it when people make very intentional choices or give themselves kind of a framework to create in. I feel like that establishes like a stronger sound, like a stronger sense of personality in people's work.
I can also tell you that Jake and I differ on a bunch of stuff. And sometimes I wish I was more like Jake, and I don't know if he cares if he wish he was more like me or not. But Jake is like the guy where it's like, if the song isn't just working out and we're not done with it in like a day or two, I don't give a shit. And I'm like, I'll work on the song for like 8 months. Right. And that's like also a nightmare. Like, I don't like that about me. And sometimes it works out and sometimes I have to throw it away and it's like killing a child.
Yeah. I'm kind of like you, man. But Jake, for you, what is the creative process there? Have you always been that way in terms of just if the idea is not clicking, move on, make a lot of stuff quickly? Yeah.
I mean, I feel like I don't have enough time for all my ideas. You know, I just like, I'll start a beat that I love. And then in like a day or two, if I'm like not in the same headspace or not feeling the same way about it as like when I wrote it, I'm like, all right, next thing. And I just move on it. Onto the next thing. I'm just like not as much of a perfectionist as Barkley is. Like with our collab on my album, Ice Cream Cone, I was like, okay, this is good enough. I like it. And he's just like, no, it has to be perfect. I'm like, Barkley, it is perfect. And he's like, no. I'm gonna take the next 3 days to meticulously
chop a note out of it, phrase by phrase for the entire song to just make it be dun 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 instead of dun dun dun.
Yeah,
that's stupid, but it like matters to me because I'm like, oh, one of those is like you can get really into it, and the other one you're like, am I really into it?
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, like you can even tell like with songs that Barkley does, like Jolene, which is like you listen to it and you're like, there are so many different sections of it, and they're all so meticulous. I'm like, I wish I had that patience and that determination to make it just right. But
that's a 6 month song though. That's like a pain song.
Yeah, it sounded like it was a pain in the ass to make, but it paid it off.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's kind
so
of.
So I am a little jealous of you for that, Barkley. You should know that.
I wish I could do it the other way.
The grass is always greener, man. I swear it's always like that. I mean, Jake, for you, if you're less precious about the little details, how do you know when something's done? How do you know when something's perfect?
I don't.
And you just don't care? You just put it out?
I'm just like, you know, it's good enough. I've just always kind of lived by like great art is never finished, only surrendered.
Ooh, man, you just hit one of the, I say that on this podcast at least once an episode.
Yeah. I mean, Da Vinci coined it and he was one of the greatest artists of all time. So I'm just like, you know, if
I mean, you're right, because that was what you were saying earlier about what I used to do. I've already progressed like insane amounts because I was like the guy that I would literally never let a track leave my grips unless it was just like immaculate. And now I'm like, I'll let it go, but oh my God, It's fucking brutal, but I'll let it go.
I mean, there's never a time where I listen back to one of my old songs where I'm like, I could have done that different. Even if at the time I was like, this is perfect. I've spent 3 months perfecting this song. And sometimes it even gets to a point where it's like, I'm working on a song and the final product is completely different from the original idea.
Yeah.
So it's just like,
yeah,
they're like timestamps of moments, you know, like with music being such a emotive art. It really depends on whatever mood that you're in at the time.
I'm working on another Pain Get Real track right now. And I swear to God, every day that I work on it, it becomes worse.
I know that feeling all too well, but you can't stop either, right? Like you have.
But every 3 days I'm like, this is just average. We got to start all over again.
Well, I will say, I think I'm a little more like you, Barclay, and Jake, I'm a little envious of the idea. Because for me, and I'm just speaking personally, not about you guys, but for me, I think it's a fear thing where every time I sit down to make another song, there's a little voice in the back of my head that's like, oh, you've forgotten how to make music. Like, you might be out of ideas. You know, and so when I get a good idea, I'm obsessed with, you know, making sure that I give it, you know, its due, as opposed to, I think what you're saying, Jake, which is that there's always going to be another idea. There's always an idea behind the idea, which is, of course, true. And we all know that's how creativity works. But it doesn't always feel like that when you're in the moment, you know?
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's definitely times where I feel like nothing is clicking and I just have to let go of just being creative for a moment, for sure.
Well, I mean, let's take it back for both of you guys in terms of creativity and making music. Jake, for you, my understanding is you've been musical more or less since childhood, right? Playing instruments.
Yeah. Instruments, bands, studio work. It's just always been a part of my life. I mean, I've done other things. I've worked in a surf shop and I did music publicity for a while.
Oh man, you were on the PR side. That's a whole different hustle.
Yeah. Yeah, actually my manager, I used to work for him and now he works for me. So
whoa.
How the turntables or whatever.
Yeah. I don't know if that's quite the phrase, but you know, I think
it works for this specific musical circumstance.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Well, I mean, was music always the thing, though? Like, when did it go from being something you loved to something you thought about doing as a career?
Well, you know, when I actually got to college, I was going to do screenplay writing. I wanted to get into film and do that sort of thing. And I was writing scripts. And I just realized maybe what I'm good at isn't aligning with what I want. So
that's an important thing.
It's interesting because I thought I was going to be a screenwriter. Oh, really? I didn't know that about you.
Wow. Yeah. I used to write tons of scripts. I'm like still working on a script. I have been for like 10 years. So we'll see if it ever gets done, but it has to be perfect. Right. So,
so this is where you're a perfectionist. It's with your scripts.
Yeah. Well, I just don't really have the confidence in it, you know?
Yeah.
Music's always been a part of my life. I've just like always written music, always played instruments and started recording my own stuff when I was like 14 or something like that. And then when I got to college, there was an electronic music program there and I just kind of discovered modular and just like the world of sound through that. Like, you know, G Jones was in my class and this other artist, Still Woozy.
Oh, wow.
And they're, yeah. And so like they were like very forward thinking artists even back then. And it just really broadened my horizons. But I think it was in college where I started to decided to start taking it more seriously.
What college was that? Shows. And what year? I'm just curious.
UC Santa Cruz. I started in 2011.
Okay. Nice, man. That's very cool. I went to college for an electronic music program, but kind of had a different experience where it was more academic and, you know, experimental and like, I don't know, like people like Alvin Lucier would come in and like give guest lectures and which all of it was amazing. But it for me, who was like a little raver kid, there was some cognitive dissonance about how this was, you know, helping me make better beats.
I was in more in your camp. I went to University of Rochester, which is partnered with Eastman School of Music, which is kind of like a Juilliard.
Oh, yeah.
And I took electronic music there. And it was like Howard Massey and like creators of synthesizers, like breaking down how the synthesizer circuitry works and stuff. And I'm like, but I just want to listen to Public Enemy and like figure this out.
was that what got you into thinking about how to make music, Barclay? Was hip hop?
No, I made music. I'm old, so like the first equipment that was coming when I was a little kid was a 4-track recorder.
Yeah.
So you could take a cassette and record 4 tracks on it instead of the one side. And I made rap beats on that. I had a Kawai drum machine that was the biggest piece of shit. But somehow I made it sound interesting. And then I would also beatbox. And I would record the rap in my bathtub and like do tape double, like play a jambox behind, like to get more tracks and more tracks. And then I made a rap album in high school and I sold it.
Really?
Door to door for cash. I made like $850.
Holy shit. That's a lot of money for back in the day.
I know.
And for a kid. Was this in Detroit?
And I had an album, like a full album. And I did a concert with dancers and everything.
No way. With dancing?
Yeah.
That's crazy. At what? Like age 16?
Yeah, 16.
That's ridiculous. And this was in Detroit?
No. I actually went to boarding school for the last 2 years of high school, and I did it in Connecticut.
Oh, wow.
where everyone's like, what the fuck are you doing?
what did it sound like?
Everyone from my teachers to my friends to everybody is like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, what is this shit?
Well, that's so funny. That makes me wonder, were your interests weird? Did you feel like an outsider or an outcast with the being interested in hip hop in Connecticut at the time?
Yeah, I was definitely in the wrong place at the wrong time. I was not in the right place at the right time. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. So like, if I had been in the right place at the right time, I would have like preceded Marky Mark and Eminem and everyone.
Right.
I was like before that.
I mean, what did it sound like? Was it good?
It was like very much in the realm of what was happening right then. So the rhyme patterns were very much in like Big Daddy Kane, Little Run DMC, kind of like not on that next like Tribe Called Quest level, like a little more 80s.
Yeah.
Feeling. In fact, I made this whole thing and then I made another demo and I went to college and one of my friends that had gone to high school with, this is just a side story, sorry.
No, this is great.
One of my friends who I went to high school with also went to the same college as me and I played in my rap demo and he's like, he's just like glazing over while I'm playing it. And I'm like, dude, what the fuck? I worked all summer on this. He's like, yeah, but you need to listen to this. And then he played me Tribe Called Quest. And I literally just quit making rap music. Look, I was like, oh, fuck. I didn't know about this one, this shit. This is so much better.
Yeah. Sounds a little bit like how Eric Clapton first heard Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Put down the guitar. She's like, I'll never be that good.
It's tough to hear something that's like so much better and you don't even know how it came about or like what the fuck is going on. And you're just like, oh my God, this is just embarrassing.
What?
Like I can't even play this music for people anymore because this is so much better. And now if they know this is out, that seems like it's from the 1800s.
but I mean, that can still happen today too, right? Even for all of us ostensible professionals here. I mean, I feel like that happens to me maybe once a year where I hear something so new or fresh or just out there, it makes me rethink my whole deal. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But it's rare that that is hitting with the mainstream American public.
That's
so
true.
Like there's artists that I find that I'm like, holy shit. And then nobody likes them. So it's like, it doesn't actually matter. Like, I don't know. It's like, okay, I'm going to be influenced by this.
Right.
But it's not like I can't keep doing what I'm doing because like nobody even knows this exists.
Well, sure. And you've established yourself, you know, like you have an identity as an artist at this point that I think, you know, outside forces can't really erode, maybe in the same way they did back in the rap album days.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, because it's all confidence. So if I had been super confident, I would have just been like, no, fuck you, my demo's sweet. And then I would have played it for everyone, but I was just like, oh, I'm going to go hide in the corner because I wasn't confident.
Do you know when you got confident? That's just an interesting thing to think about.
In some ways, my parents gave me this like overall confidence, like this delusional feeling that I was great. God bless them. Like they're so awesome parents that they just kind of instilled in me some kind of like delusion that I was the greatest. And so I just believed them.
Was it the kind of parenting where it was the you can be anything you want to be?
Yes. Yeah. All day long. Mm. But then when I got to like 30 and I was like duplicating DVDs, I was like, oh my God, what if I'm not the greatest?
I mean, well, that's interesting too, right? Is I think like those, the longer careers and the people who take a little longer to get to whatever the final form is, I think in the modern scene in 2021, almost 2022 now, there's almost this expectation when someone's a new artist that's like, oh, well, I got 1 year to, you know, to really make it on the stage. And I don't know. I like talking about the longer journeys, man, because it never gets talked about. And I don't think people understand that it's even possible.
Yeah, I think that like Jake here could just make music for like 30 years. But he probably doesn't think of it like that. I don't know. Do you?
I don't know where I'm going to end up.
You feel like there's a timeline where you have to be like a huge artist or no?
I mean, it's working out for now.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, I always talk about like, I mean, you know how like daunting the road can be sometimes, just like being on the road and just a lot of the self-doubt that can come from it and these like kind of really bad moments of being on the road, like playing a really, really bad show. And you're like, oh, am I on the right path? Am I doing the right thing? Am I doing what's best for me? And I think about like, well, I've spent my entire life making music. I could probably get into like scoring film or like doing audio production work for other people. But yeah, I don't know. I think I could keep going.
Yeah. Do you have a goal in mind? Do you have a vision for like the final form of the project or the next step in an ideal world?
Oh man, I don't know. Just one step at a time. I mean, I've got goals, you know, festivals I want to play, milestones I want to reach, but.
Well, was putting out the album a goal? Was putting out an album a goal?
Well, yeah. I mean, like when I was at Santa Cruz, I used to work at, I used to volunteer at the college radio station and I would catalog their electronic music CDs. Yeah. And I just spent like hours and hours and hours, just going through the CDs and like listening to the music and cataloging it in their system. So they had like an electronic records of what they had physically. And I remember stumbling upon Barclay's music. I was maybe like a freshman in college.
Wow.
And I was just like, damn, if I'm going to be taken as a serious artist, like I have to start releasing albums.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
And it was, I never told you this, Barkley, but
yeah,
it was
like album in your catalog.
What you had, it was like Bird Brain and, it was like your first three albums that I found. And I was like, yeah,
that's
this is
crazy. It's so funny when you say that you're cataloging the electronic music for a college radio station. It never even crossed my mind that I would be in it. It's so weird. I'm like, oh, he's just going through like all the old Chemical Brothers and Sneaker Pimps and like all the stuff that was. I was in college.
they were in it too. But yeah, you were in it. Finding your records were like very life changing. I'd say as in terms of like how I thought an artist should, what the path should be for that.
Mm. Interesting. Cool.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And the album itself, I mean, I think I know you've both told this story a little bit, but for anybody who doesn't know, I feel like we should tell the origin story of the album itself, which the seed of it started, Barkley, when you asked Jake to start doing some streams for the Dirty Bird Twitch channel.
Yeah, we hit COVID and we had nothing to do here. So we started a TV network. And a lot of people just kind of thought of shows, but a lot of the shows were like, I'm just getting on my blue screen and or my green screen and just DJing. But then, I was talking to Max or you directly. I don't even know.
Yeah. You asked me
and you're like, I can do the modular show. And I'm like, yeah, please do a different kind of show. And then he did the coolest show, which was all freestyle modular for like multiple hours, and it was so interesting, so much more interesting to watch than the other shows. No offense to all the other shows, sorry. Anyway, I really thought it was a cool show because it was all original and it was just happening, and sometimes it'd be really funny and sometimes it would be bad and sometimes it'd be like cool, like it just went everywhere. And it's just kind of fascinating to watch it. And I'm like, if you could capture this thing into a record, I think you would have something.
And how did you feel about that at the time, Jake, when it was suggested to you?
I was honored, really, to do an album for Dirty Bird. But I was reluctant to give up like creative control of my work, you know? But luckily Barkley he trusted me with it. He really liked what I was doing. And it was really cool to do the modular jam stuff. Cause like Barkley said, not all of it was great, you know, but it was all analog. It was just a drum machine and my modular rig. And yeah, usually it was like 2 hours of me pretending to be like Jeff Goldblum or something like that. It was just like absolutely ridiculous.
Right.
It was great. And I'm like, you really want an album of this?
Yeah.
Well, what was the process of chopping it down from hours and hours and hours of audio and into, you know, a cohesive album?
Well, Barkley asked me to do it in May of this year. He was like, yo, I think you should. It was some, I forget the timeline, but I didn't start it until June. And then it was like, okay, for the next 6-7 weeks, I'm going to track every sound individually. Into my computer, and through it we were pushing like a Discord community thing, and we kind of made it like a bit interactive, getting like the fans and the people that would watch the streams involved with the creative process of it. So I would go through, you know, each week after the jam and like chop out loops that I thought were cool and send them into the Discord and be like, hey, what do you guys think, which ones should I finish? And I think by the time like the album was like starting to actually like me starting to finish the songs, I had something like 50 or 60 loops or something. It was roughly 21 hours of audio that I was like sifting through to begin the album. And then it was like 5 or 6 weeks of like actually working on the music. And I think it kind of changed a lot from like those original ideas to like what the final songs were. But the process of it was so much fun.
It's an interesting, sorry, not to cut you off, but just, it's really interesting to think about the, it's almost like you were collaborating with your past self in a way, where it's, you know, if the end product wasn't exactly what the raw material was, it's almost like you just, it's almost like getting inspired off of something your past self did. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, I saw thousands of projects that I have not gone back into, and I'm sure there is some hidden gold in there somewhere, but
I'm sure. This is an interesting thing because I also shifted maybe 2 or 3 years ago into this kind of formula for myself. I used to be, like what I was talking about before, the guy who starts one song and just beats it to death until it's done. And then I started working with this guy, Mike Monday, who I don't work with him anymore, but he's amazing. And he's kind of just like a time management, kind of like how you work, Jake. Like I would just make 150 loops and then do like the NCAA tournament. Like, here's my 150 loops. These 75 are better. Let's move them into the next round. And then let's just get it down to 12 tracks and make a record. And that has been working really well because you can, just the fact that you can bounce around once you're stuck to another track is just so freeing. And you can just come back to it and be like, oh, duh, that was just so obvious. Like, let's take this thing out and whatever. Just taking the 2 days off from it or whatever you have to take off to come back fresh is super valuable. And I know Justin Jay does this even more than us. Like, he'll just make 5 billion ideas, yeah. And then just turn them, like, three of them into tracks. He's even more nutty.
Yeah,
he really is.
I definitely know some people who work that way too, and it's really interesting. I think for those people, the it's almost file management becomes a separate problem.
I use Trello. If anybody I use a Trello board, and it literally goes like, I'm not even joking. It's like, here's the panel of the shit, and this shit just whittles down to the cream.
Mm. That's actually a pretty good method. Yeah.
I've seen Wyatt use the same method. I'm assuming he got that from you.
Yeah, it worked.
Hmm. Well, what was the process like for your guys' collab on the album that we mentioned before with Ice Cream Cone? How did the two creative processes from both of you come together?
I went over there. I don't usually go to people's studios, but I went over there and I just took like an MPC and just made a raw skeleton beat. And then he started running the modular. And then it just started coming out. We made two things and one of them was clearly better. So that we just went with that.
How about
for
you, Jake?
Same kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, Jake, what was it like from your end? Once Barclay was there in your studio?
I mean, I always prefer to work with somebody in person as well. And Barclay and I have different ideas for our processes, as we've mentioned before. But working with Barclay was great. I mean, he has a very clear vision of what it should sound like. And I'm just like, I just like to fuck around until I find something I like. So it was an interesting
it was great because it's almost like, I think those two things work together well because basically I would sit there, we just run a loop and then Jake just like makes sounds until I'm like, oh, that's the sound, right? Don't move the knob.
Right.
Let's get that in or whatever. And then go and make another one 5 minutes later until we have like 15 pieces that we can fuck around with.
Yeah, it's a good dynamic.
That song, absolutely. Also, I mean, like, lyrically, the content wouldn't exist without Barclay's input. Like, when he was leaving the studio, it was, like, kind of the end of the day, and he was like, all right, you got to do something like how you did on the streams. Just be, like, silly. Talk about, like, going to an ice cream shop or something. I'm like, oh, ice cream. Ice cream. Okay. And then I did the original vocals, and when I sent it to Barclay, he was like, this is great. I just wish you could sing.
No, I even tried to auto-tune. We came very close to using that. It was close.
Yeah.
It wasn't that bad. It was just that we just
had I needed a few more years of vocal coaching.
No, we just had to have the combo of like, this is a pretty good, but it could be like a really good track if we like got somebody who could really execute it.
And then who was the original vocalist? I don't have it in front of me. Or the final vocalist?
Life on Planets.
Right.
He's like part of the Crew Love guys, like that entire collective of people, like Soul Claps label. And he's got kind of more of like this R&B housey sound on his own work. And I just thought like having him, especially like how like much of an innuendo all the lyrics are throughout the song.
You know, I don't know if this was intentional at all, but it reminded me of like a modern update of that old track Breakfast by Lele.
Yeah.
The one that's Bitch You Breakfast.
It's definitely in the sandwiches, breakfast, ice cream cone.
Yeah.
It's in this, I have a food and I'm going to make it a sexual innuendo mode.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is, it's funny that there's like a rich tradition of those songs, but there kind of is at this point.
Yeah, there really is. I have to say, Sandwiches is probably, it's got to be one of the best songs ever. Detroit Grand Poobah's.
Incredible song.
The idea of that, those lyrics, they're just fucking amazing.
Well, and it's one of those songs, I don't know, to me, it's one of those songs where it's Sandwiches is so weird, but yet also such a banger, you know?
It's so good.
Yeah.
You can play that at any party.
That's the thing, yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm reaching for this analogy, but I feel like there's sort of a Dirty Bird like parallel to that.
Oh yeah.
Where it's,
I'm friends with Paris, the guy that is the vocalist in Sandwiches.
Okay.
And, like, certain things influenced me dramatically at the start of Dirty Bird. One was Green Velvet Percolator. I was like, if you can make a song that sounds really cool and is a total joke, you are a fucking genius. And it's not, and no one thinks it's corny. Like that is the that is a really hard, almost impossible achievement.
Yeah.
And Curtis is so good at that. So I was obsessed with him and Detroit Grand Poobah's that, and just like stuff like that. Just that where you could get it, it would still be considered super dope in the club. Or you're just joking around.
Yeah. When I feel like there's that sense of fun in kind of everything Dirty Bird does to a certain extent. Would you agree?
Yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah.
People go to parties to have fun. That was one of the original reasons that Dirty Bird started, is because we were jungle DJs and it got so dark that it was just dudes in hoodies and hiding in the corner. And we're like, how can we get girls to come to this party? Let's put house beat behind it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge, huge jungle drum and bass fan. And so, I mean, no disrespect to that scene, but I feel like they're still dealing with that problem of how do we get girls to show up to this?
Yeah. It's true.
Yeah. This kind of brings me to something I wanted to talk to both of you about anyway, which was, I'm going to try to make a connection here. So Jake, I was reading on your website, like in your official artist bio, it talks about the phrase like rave culture a couple times, and that rave culture is like an inspiration to you, something that's sort of holy or important to you. And Barkley, I was listening to your new track with the aforementioned Justin J. Which also kind of harkened back to older rave days, older rave culture, maybe some of the original culture that inspired Dirty Bird. And I kind of just wanted to talk about the concept. Like, what is the culture in rave culture mean to you guys? How do you see it in 2021? Because as somebody who kind of was a raver kid, I started raving in the late 90s. Obviously, it's changed and evolved and broken apart and come back together a million times since then. And so I just wanted to talk, you know, whatever that means to you, whatever images it brings up, like that idea of rave culture, what does it mean to you guys in terms of what you're doing these days?
Well, I think when I first started raving, there was just such an inclusivity of it. I mean, people were just so nice, you know, as opposed to like other shows I've been to where people like weren't that much. I mean, like it was the first time I'd go to a show and I'd see like five dudes hugging and crying with each other,
yeah,
like to Cascade or something. I'm like, this is incredible. it's so funny. And the music was just great. I mean, like I had always really connected with house music, and I have such a love for like old house music as well. And I always love to think about how everybody in the 90s that were making house music, they were like, we need to make music of the future. And now we have music today. And I was like, we need to make music that sounds like it's from the past. And, you know, there was just such a level of creativity in the 90s in dance music that I think people are starting to wake back up to nowadays. Like there's just so many like breakbeats and people getting back in the jungle and just fun music, you know? And I just love how there's such a breadth of sound in that. But yeah, I think rave culture is a different thing to everybody.
Yeah.
But I do love Plur. I think it's hilarious that it started kind of in New York. I think Frankie Bones actually coined it. He was at a party and a fight broke out. Like one of his parties is like, everybody love each other, peace, love, and unity, or I'm going to bash your fucking heads in, which is like the most New York shit ever.
Yeah. They later edited that last part to be respect. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I thought it was peace, love, unity, and raga, raga, raga. Barkley, what's rave culture to you?
Yeah.
I want to hear your take.
Yeah. I mean, this is a, I feel very strongly about this because I've been, I mean, I don't know if I'm answering the question directly. I'm going to go roundabout mode, but I feel like at a certain point we released some records. This always happens. This happened a million times here. We released a record that is just like the forecasting what's going to happen for the next 2 years. And we released a few records that basically forecasted this like bro house, I'm going to drink beer out of a shoe and be a frat boy and take my shirt off vibe, fist pump it. And I didn't even know that was going to happen. I just picked these records out because they were hot records. Then that kind of happened and we got associated with that. And then it really went nuclear without us.
Right.
And it was hard to kind of like to kind of explain to people, that's not what we're releasing. Go listen to what we're releasing. And they're like, no, you only released this. This is, you do this now. And I feel like the last like year and a half, 2 years has been like me pulling the fucking sailboat back. Like, like let's get the reins on the sail because it just like started flapping out in the wind. And Jake's album is part of this like thing. And this whole white label series that we've been doing has really been working. Like even at the holiday party, I know it's subtle, but I've already noticed it that just like leading by example and doing the things that are more interesting and underground, even the people that used to just play all bro-y bangers are starting to play techno records and things. And it's like, it's starting to work. And I'm just trying to keep, because I don't think that other model is for me or sustainable.
Mm. I mean, yeah, it's an interesting idea, right? That, you know, for a lot of people, house music has gotten big in the last couple of years, whereas you've been here planting a flag for house music for, you know, decades. Do you see yourself as part of that larger scene, whether that means, you know, EDM or, you know, the how dance music has gone mainstream in the last 10 years in the States? Or do you see what you're doing with Dirty Bird and the whole family you've built there as separate from that?
No, we're definitely part of the scene, 100% part of the scene. We're like the middle trickle down. So there's like the, you get your like whatever super EDM commercial radio shit, and then it's like trickles down to the little bit more chilled out, then it trickles down to Dirty Bird, and then it trickles down to like I only listen to compact vinyl. Spiker 247 B-side.
Right. Well, it's funny. I read it again in an old interview, just an interesting kind of tossed off comment. You were talking to whoever you were talking to about how you would always, back in the, you know, the A-side, B-side release days, you would always have the banger on the A-side and the more experimental one on the B-side.
I still don't understand why this isn't common practice. It's the smartest. It always works. You suck people into the A side and then they end up liking the B side better, but they would never listen to the B side if you didn't have the A side.
But I mean, do you think that's still possible in the modern paradigm of releasing music?
Probably not. I still do it because I love it, but also I feel like it gives you a little bit of range. Like you can get a little bit away with a little bit more on the A side if you really say, hey, I'm still here on the B side. but no one cares. I mean, everyone just is like, did you release a record in the last 6 weeks? Because I forgot about you.
Which is true. And I mean, that can be a frustrating thing. I mean, how have you had to evolve either as an artist or as a label over the years as platforms change and distribution changes and the trends? I mean, Dirty Bird has been so solid for so long, whereas a lot of labels have not been able to ride those waves as well, I think.
I mean, Jake, why don't you talk about how hard it is to do a label?
Oh, well, yeah, man. That's right, Jake, because you do that too, right?
Yeah.
It's brutal, I mean, right?
It is brutal. We slowed down a lot with Perkomaniacs this year after the release of my remix LP, of my first album. And I was just like, I got to take a break from this. It's tough because like not every release is going to do really well. And like, you kind of just are funneling money into it and it becomes more of a promotional thing as opposed to like just the love of the music at times, you know, and having that constant need to fill the void with another release. And sometimes you end up just like signing filler tracks, or at least some people would think that. But yeah, I've done label management for Desert Hearts. I still do label management for Super Freak, and you know, still run Perkomaniacs, and just try to do it right. Release the right records at the right time, and you're never going to have the exact, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess know-how to know exactly when to release a record. Just kind of throw it out and hope for the best.
I think a record label is much more of a branding project than a record label project at this point. It's like the record label is almost an artist at this, like, if it's gonna work, because there's really no reason why you would sign on to a record label unless the record label really means something to the public, which is like I would hate to start a new label because it's like, really, it's a lot of pain to get to that point where people are like, oh, I've heard of that. And not only I've heard of that, but I like it enough to where I'll listen to the new thing that's coming out on it because I think that they're good at what they do. The levels of that is like, how many, like, yeah, I've heard of it. I like it. I'll listen to a new release. I'll listen to all the new releases. I'll go to a party. It's like the chain is so difficult.
And all it takes is one release they don't like for them to be like, oh, yeah, they've fallen off. I don't want
exactly
to hear them again.
If I went on Reddit, I would just commit suicide because everything is going to be like, oh, did you hear that new release? Dirty Bird is over.
Well, how quickly did Dirty Bird start expanding from just an outlet for music to, you know, the sort of fully fledged entity it is today?
That's pretty much all my wife. I ran Dirty Bird by myself with like some ragtag help. I had some help, but it was just me like just being a dictator. Like I learned everything, Photoshop, royalties, everything myself. And that is really a bad way to run your label. It's like the worst idea ever. So when Andi came in, she's like a high level marketing executive for huge companies. And she was able to get it to where it needed to go by just like collecting data and all these things that I would never think of.
Yeah. So that but combo.
We still had to have this like trustable. It's like she came in and worked with the clay. The clay was already awesome. It was like the best clay that you could get, but there was no like sculpture yet until she, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Barkley, I actually have a question for you regarding that. Did you feel that starting the record label helped you grow your name, or did you feel that because you were already beginning to have a name, having a record label was just like the next step? Like, did they go hand in hand, or did
They really went hand in hand. There was no way for me to really know 100% like what was really the thing, because I had like big tracks right at the same time that the label started. So I hate to say this, but like a hit track is the solution to everything. like it's kind of like when they say like winning in football, it doesn't matter. As long as you're winning, no one cares if you're like got some weird fetish or if you're like some delinquent coach or something, as long as you're winning.
Yeah.
But whatever. I'm not saying that about myself. I'm just saying like the having the tracks work out is really what it makes it easier. It makes it a lot easier. But the other thing that no one does, which is just shocking to me, is because the American scene has gotten to like where everyone can make decent money. Like, I can't believe that no one does this anymore. Like, we really built our bread and butter grassroots fan base on either weekly, monthly, or quarterly parties where it was branded and it was like our night.
Yeah.
And no one does that because the paychecks are too good elsewhere. But that's like the easiest formula to getting it to go. Cause you also get to try out all your shit. You see the reactions, like everything about it is good. You learn the mechanics of a party, why a party works, why a party doesn't work. It's like everything is there, but it's a ball ache.
Right. I mean, it's building a community too, right? Like it's literally, if you just show up every week and people know they can rely on it. I mean, that's how it starts, right? That's how that community starts.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like AC Slater is maybe the last person I saw who really did that with his night.
Yeah, he's done it. Good job with that.
Yeah. Barkley, I wanted to ask you, because, you know, you were talking about the having the banger, having the hit song while you were starting the label, which, you know, we joked earlier, you were in the wrong place at the wrong time, but this seems like you were in the right place at the right time, everything aligning. Before everything aligned, what was life like when you were still really grinding it out? What did that look like? What are your memories of that time when you were really trying to make it, but it hadn't happened yet?
I had a lot of specific, like, negative memories. Like, I made this whole drum and bass EP, and I took it into the coolest jungle shop in San Francisco, and they're like, what are you doing here? Like, we're not going to sell this. Like, I got the most negative feedback you could get.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh. And then I did like a bunch of different nights that were just absolute failures, like weeklies, like, oh my God, like three people show up, six people show up. I didn't care. I would just keep trying it. And all that stuff, it seems like it's a total disaster at the time, but it's all really good for later when you know everything about how everything works. And like, why didn't they take my record at the Jungle Shop? Why did no one come to my party? Like, if you really start thinking about like all this shit, you can figure it out. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and part of that, I always talk about this idea that, you know, success, like the only real definition of success is not quitting, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I almost quit a bunch of different times, but I just kept catching the bug over and over again until I just finally scored a basket, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's what it is, man. I think like we were talking about creativity and songwriting before, too. That's the same thing. You know, you got to keep putting up the shots till you hit one, even if you're sitting there for a week thinking you don't know how to make music anymore. If you stop, then you're definitely not going to make anything good again, right? It's just interesting thing about that. Am I right, by the way? This is another very random old interview poll. I read that you were living in an abandoned factory at some point.
Who, me or Jake?
No, you.
Oh, no. I could see how you that could be portrayed that way. But no, it was like a loft building, like a converted factory.
Oh, like
a
converted warehouse kind of building. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Got you. That makes a lot more sense.
It was very cheap. And I was on this constant thing where all my neighbors thought that all the noise complaints were coming to me, but it wasn't me. And these guys were like adamant that it was my bass. And I'd be like, dude, I wasn't even here yesterday. And everyone hated me in the building and it wasn't even me. I don't know what was going on in that building. It was crazy. It was all music producers. It was like DJ Bone and all these guys from Detroit.
And somehow but you were the one who me. Got blamed.
Well, the word went around the building that I was the guy, but I wasn't the guy.
Wonderful. I mean, Jake, how about for you? I mean, talking about, do you still see yourself as being in the grind period of your career? Like, have you had any of those moments yet where it really felt like, okay, this is starting to pick up, like we're catching a spark here?
Yeah. I think like just before the pandemic, I was like gaining some, like, I felt like some serious traction, you know, like I was getting ready to release my first album and I was starting to feel the momentum really pick up. I was getting a lot of like these big bookings that I'd always looked forward to. Like I was going to play Lightning in a Bottle, and just stuff like that, getting really good set times at some of these festivals. And then it kind of all crashed down. I'd say, you know, the quarantine was like pretty dark time for me, just a lot of like, I don't know if it's ever coming back. I figured I picked the wrong career, like this sucks, yada yada. But luckily it's felt like I'm having another second wind here, especially with this album release and how it's been received, and all the shows on the tour have been really, really amazing. Yeah, it feels like I'm on a right path still, or at least, you know, for now it feels really good.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, that's, how do you in general keep yourself on an even keel? How do you ride those waves of, you know, the pandemic, obviously a huge wave for anybody doing what we do, but just in general, you do this long enough, you'll have plenty of waves. How do you stay happy and excited about what you're doing? How do you, you know, understand that the bad moments will pass? Like what part of what you guys do is the most exciting right now?
Well, I'd say, you know, music's always been a part of my life. So I just keep making it. you know, and it's finding moments to take care of myself as well, like doing something active, saying no sometimes to going out, just like, oh, I don't need to do that. And just like kind of taking care of myself and watching my mental health. Or if people are telling me, hey, like, you know, chill for a bit or whatever, and just taking a moment to breathe. So, but also recognizing that things will pass. Like I had a really, really, really terrible show in New York recently, and our set time just got moved around a ton. It was supposed to be from 11 to 2, and then it was 12 to 2 and 4 to 6. And then it was like, you guys are playing from 3 to 6. And it was in New York. I had flown out. I played two songs. It was a back-to-back with me, Ribo, and Wyatt. We played two songs each, and they're like, yeah, we're cutting you off. So after like flying across the country, playing two tracks, it was devastating. I was like, this is our party, and we got like really dicked around. And I was I went to the Brooklyn Mirage after. I was like, okay, I got to salvage this night somehow. And I'm just like backstage, and Dixon is playing, 6,000 people are there. And I'm just like basically complaining about how shitty the gig that we just played was. And I'm like, I don't know if I could do this anymore. I'm fucking over it. I don't want to go play a show for, you know, two songs. And this was just terrible. I don't know if I'm in the right place. And then my friend was just like, you know, it's the little things, like, just, you know, you're going to have shows like this. Just take those moments for granted, or don't take those moments for granted. Like something will happen and it'll remind you that you're doing the right thing. And then at that very moment, Dixon started playing the first single off my new album. I'm like, you know what? They were right. And I just got to take it all with a grain of salt. You know, each of these moments is a learning experience to just keep my head up.
Oh, that's beautiful, man. I mean, how about you, Barkley? Because I'm sure long enough career, you've had plenty of bad gigs sprinkled in there.
Yeah, for sure. It's a good question. Something that I think I actually need to do is take some time off.
Yeah.
I haven't been doing it, and I feel like we really run a hard shop here. Like we run one festival and the day it ends, we start to figure out the announcement on the next one. And we run merch like 3 lines a year, and I make music every day, and I tour on the weekends, and I have kids. And yeah, it can get a little bit intense, but everything is going great. It's just, I do feel like sometimes I could just go to like some island for like 3 days and just not talk to anyone.
I literally got back from a 4-day trip to an island 2 days ago, and I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, I'm way overdue.
Are you the kind of person who has trouble taking time off? Like, do you get antsy on vacation?
I get anxiety on vacation, but I really only need 3 days. I can do 3 days, then I start having crazy amounts of ideas. And I just start writing them down in my notepad. Anything longer than like 10 days, and I'm just like, I'm ready to work really like a nut. Yeah. But I haven't taken 10 days off in like, I can't even remember. Because in my life, it's like, there is no real time off, because everything that's time off is like, oh, we're going to finish visit our 19 relatives.
Right.
It's
right.
Not like actual time off.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no actual like you time, you know, just
there's
time
no off. Like actual vacation.
Right.
How long were you in you went to Iceland recently, right?
Oh, Barkley? That was a good one. You're right. That was awesome. That was our family went to Iceland. When was that? Like it's 6 months ago, months ago?
2 or 3 months ago. Not even that long.
No, that was like way longer than 2 or 3 months
ago. No, because I did the birdhouse for you.
It was great. Whatever that was, it was great.
Yeah. Well, just balancing all of that, man, it's got to be, I don't know. Do you like, if you're the kind of person who gets antsy on vacation, are you also the kind of person who likes being busy? You like having all the time filled?
I mean, if you just look at the amount of projects that come out of here, you'd probably notice that I like being busy.
Yeah.
but it would be, I would like to focus a little bit more. One of the things that I would like to change is just being, having like a bunch of time to just be like, okay, now I'm just making tracks for like these 6 weeks. Cause I just chop it all up into a bunch of little pieces. And sometimes I literally just get into a groove, like a 1 hour of no one bugging me. And then everyone will be like, no, you have this thing that you have to do now. And you have to go over here and do this, this, and this. And I'm like, I just got into the groove on this track like 1 minute ago.
Yeah, it's tough, man. I don't know. It's your output from your artist project, from Dirty Bird, all of that. I mean, I don't think there's many people in the game touching just that amount of high quality shit being produced on a consistent basis for such a long time. It's kind of crazy if you think about it.
That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
we just keep planning more stuff. That's great.
That's good, man. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. I'm very glad you're there doing it. I think it's much needed for our scene, especially right now. But look, I want to ask you guys just one last quick random question each, and then I'll wrap it up. These are not questions related to anything else. They're just things on my list that we haven't touched on yet. Jake, very quickly, I just had to ask. I saw a quote from you saying that it was your grandma who introduced you to electronic music.
Yes, it was.
How did that work?
She was just like really into like down tempo electronica. When I was a kid, she showed me like Moby and Fatboy Slim and the Gorillaz and Portishead and Massive Attack. And that was just like the music that she liked. I mean, she was very eclectic. She loved vodka and liked psychedelics and was like a therapist, and yeah, just interesting lady. But you know, I also had, my parents were really into music as well. My dad's a huge classic rock head, like really drove like Led Zeppelin and The Who and the Rolling Stones, Grateful Dead into my catalog of music that I like. And my mom likes R&B and hip hop and some more like pop leaning stuff like Sade and Aaliyah and Alicia Keys and Outkast. So very grateful for all the music that has come into my life from my elders. But yeah, big ups to my grandma for listening to cool ass electronic music for sure.
It's kind of amazing. I've never heard of like a raver grandma before doing these interviews. It's great.
Yeah. She bought me Moby's Play, like one of my favorite albums of all time when I was like 7 or 8 years old,
man.
And would just listen to it on one of those like little portable CD players, like all the time.
It's amazing, man. I'm sure they must've been stoked for you, like doing what you're doing now, right?
Tough to say. they're creatives as well. So I think they have some fundamental understanding of what I do, but they also don't understand dance music at all.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Yeah. Maybe stoked is too strong a word, but you know, some connection to it.
My mom is definitely stoked now because she has friends that like my music and she's like, oh my God.
That's awesome. Well, Barkley, very different question, but I wanted to mention, I've seen you talk a lot about early on, you know, we were talking, you were maybe going to be a script writer. You were working on film very early in your life. And there's this documentary that you worked on early in your career where you went and interviewed a whole bunch of prominent DJs at the time and made this whole project around it. And for anybody who's interested, I mean, you just Google it. You've done plenty of interviews talking about it. But I wanted to ask you, you probably know this, it was interesting for me to hear that you did this project interviewing DJs before you were really a DJ and a producer yourself as like, you know, as a profession. Are you aware that Judd Apatow basically did the same thing for comedians when he was a kid?
Oh, he interviewed comedians?
Yeah. Like he did like hundreds of these interviews with very famous comedians when he was still a young kid. And that was kind of his start getting
into. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know why it works? It's because why do you go to college or why do you go to grad school? You just want to figure out like what you're going to do. So actually going and talking to people who do it, and a lot of them, and then in the case of making a documentary where you're like going through the footage for over and over and over and over and editing and cutting and like watching it 200 times. Yeah, it was like graduate school. I talked to 50 DJs. I watched their footage for thousands of hours. I shot, edited, made songs that sounded like them because I couldn't afford their music. It was literally just like, how do you do it? This is how you do it. And then I just did it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something so valuable, especially at a young age, young stage of your career, to just talk to somebody and be like, how did you do this? Because for what we do, there's not much of a roadmap.
Yeah, it was actually a kind of a desperation attempt anyway, because of those stories that I told you. The me walking into the jungle shop is not story number one. It's like story number 10.
Yeah.
And I was like, so I could sit here and make a whole bunch of new tracks and do the same thing that I've been doing and not know what the fuck to do with the tracks after I'm done with them. It's the making of the tracks is not my problem. My problem is getting people to listen to the tracks once they're made. So that was the equation that I had to solve. And that movie helped me solve that equation.
Well, and I love that. I love solving a life problem, a career problem with a project, right?
Yeah.
Like using creativity to solve something that's blocking you. I think that's super inspirational.
Thanks.
Yeah. No, it's cool.
It was actually quite a brutal project. It also taught me like the value of completing something that almost should not be completed because everyone hates you. You borrowed money from your like sister's dog. Like you have nothing and everyone is like, why are you doing this? You're killing yourself. And you still finish it. That was a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a catalyst to like, oh, I know I can go all the way to the brink and still be okay.
Mm, yeah, it's true. And you don't know until you do it. I think that's right. Absolutely right. Well, hey, man, guys, both of you, thank you for doing this, taking the time. I'm really enjoying talking to you guys. Before I ask you the final question, is there anything else we haven't talked about? Anything else you want to get out there? Anything else that's on your mind?
Listen to Lebowski's album.
Yes. Listen to my album.
I did it again.
Oh, man. Barkley, every time you did. Every time I meet somebody new, though, I'm like, have you heard my album? And I think to myself, Barkley would be so proud of me right now. He'd be so proud that I'm literally a walking billboard.
No, but you were about to say, I don't think there's anything else.
I was going to say it, and then you beat me to it. You didn't even give me a chance, dude. Yes, go stream my album, go buy it, go listen to it, go burn a CD of it and throw it into the street like Ninja Stars. Do whatever. Just go. Go consume it, please.
Thank you.
Participate in the listening of my new album.
It's a fantastic
album. Tell me it's
album.
Good. Tell me it's bad. It's good.
It's good.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. No, it's great, man. And thank you guys for doing this. The final question, this is just something I ask at the end of each one of these interviews. It's just a quick kind of first thing that pops into your head kind of question. Just looking for a time in your life, a moment, a memory. Could be from any time in your life when in a single moment, music really deeply affected you, really had a deep impact on you in that moment. And that's meant to be extremely broad. There's no wrong answer. Kind of just the first thing that pops into your head.
Parker, you want to start?
Yeah. I mean, there was a moment that I have talked about before where I was living in that abandoned factory in Detroit, but it did have like the whole side of the building was windows. And I was just looking at the Detroit skyline and I had missed this entire chunk of electronic music. I can't remember what I just like. It was like one of the times when I abandoned making music and I just didn't listen to it for like 3 or 4 years. And my friend gave me a mixtape and I just was like looking over the horizon of the city. And it was like, Ed Rush and Optical, early stuff, Pansia, like all this insane jungle drum and bass. And I was like, I don't know what the fuck happened, but I was just like, who are these fucking people? What are they doing? Where are they from? How did they get these sounds? What is this? And I was just like, it definitely changed my life. Just this one mixtape from Mike Hayner. What's up, Mike Hayner?
Nice. Well, that's something beautiful too, that you remember looking at the skyline. Like, I think that's, for me, some of my most precious memories. There's always music tied into it, you know?
Yeah.
It really like crystallizes it. Yeah, I don't know. That's a beautiful image, man. I love that. Jake, what about you?
I'd say probably my first Desert Heart set was like a really big moment for me. I had decided to play like a fully original set. And it was like in the middle of the afternoon. And I just did my thing. It was the biggest crowd I'd ever played for. It's like 5,000-6,000 people on the dance floor. And it was just, you know, sun was out and everyone was having a good time. And it just like felt like everything was really clicking for me. Just like how people were responding to like my sound. And I just, yeah, I was just incredibly grateful in that moment. And it was just a beautiful afternoon. And well, I just remember seeing that sea of like beautiful faces and like audacious and colorful clothing. And it was just, yeah, it was definitely a moment.
Well, that's what I was about to say, is what you're talking about. It sounds like to me just actually being present and being in the moment at, you know, maybe an important time in your career or, you know, what seemed like a really important time then, like, That's a beautiful thing too, because I think it's so easy to be thinking about, oh, what's the next step? What's the next goal? How is this going? That it's sometimes hard to just be in the moment and experience it as it's happening to you. That's really nice, man, that you could, you know, take in that moment while you were there.
Yeah, the only other time I've really felt like that was at Dirty Bird Campout this year, this last one that happened. By a series of fortunate events, my set time got pushed to like 8 to 9:30, and you know, being able to like play the album to like that crowd, like I almost cried at the end of my set, like with, you know, just feeling that gratitude again, and you know, having Barkley trust me with the album and feeling it all culminate in that moment.
Man, that's beautiful right there, man. I think that's really what it's all about, is those full circle moments, right? Where, all the grinding and the stress that we were talking about earlier, you know, those moments I think make it worth it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you guys for taking the time. I hope you had a great time. It was awesome talking to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Always great chatting.
Yeah, man, absolutely. Come back anytime. We'll do a part two whenever you guys want, man. Thank you.
Awesome. All right, man. Yeah, just let me know when you schedule Artie so I can crash his.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, guys, have a good rest of your day.
Happy holidays.
Yeah, you thanks too, man. Peace. Take care.